Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Here we are once again. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So I had a recent conversation that was kind of related to a couple of things we've talked about, and I thought it would be good to talk through this morning. It was actually talking about language and specifically profanity and sort of like where does foul language fit into everything? How do we make sense of that? And it really came, the context of the story was, you know, this person hangs out with his friends and jokes and someone else he knew, you know, had just mentioned, well, I don't want you using those words around me. Right. And it led into a great conversation specifically about profanity, but I thought it was actually touched on a lot more broader and deeper conversations that we've had in the past on language. So maybe you could tee us up here. Like, why is it, particularly from our faith background, why is language and the language we use important?
Yeah, that's a great question. So here we go. And we will end up all the way back at profanity. We might even reconsider when Bono, U2, said, well, that is just effing great. In other words, there was a whole lot of believers who they fell off their chair when they heard that. And it tells you something about language. And here's a way to think about it, that scripture historically has depicted language as a lagging cultural indicator. And so on this podcast, if you get nothing more out of this and you fall asleep, well, actually you won't be driving to work. But if you fall asleep, it's a lagging cultural indicator. Now, obviously I'm teeing off from economists say there are leading economic indicators and there are lagging economic indicators. Do you know the difference between the two, Pat? Can you give me an example?
Just conceptually, obviously, if the economy is going to take a downturn, from economist's perspective, there's a leading indicator saying, hey, this is coming up, and lagging would happen once the downturn has already happened. It just hasn't maybe hit as hard yet.
That's right. So a leading indicator, for example, is bond yields. Economists will pay attention to bond yields because they are generally predictive of future growth or decline. And a lagging indicator typically lags behind a decline or an increase. And so, for example, the rate of unemployment, which is on the news right now, is simply reflective rather than predictive that something happened in March in the economy. And if you're listening to this in April of 2020, you know, it was a pandemic. So first is understanding that as a believer, what do we mean by language and words? And they are what are called a lagging cultural indicator. Now, what does that mean? So we have to go all the way back to the opening of the Bible. And Pat, you're a shrewd Bible student. How did God create? Did God, you know, get in CrossFit for, you know, roughly a few millennium and get buffed up and get, you know, look like Arnold Schwarzenegger and then, or Charles Atlas, and then he started to create? Is that how he did it?
You know, if memory suits me, I don't believe so.
It's actually if memory serves you. So language is very important.
See, this is great. No.
That's right. We know. How did he do it?
He spoke.
That's
spoke
right.
Things into existence.
He spoke things out of it. That's remarkable. So right away we know there is something mystical and spiritual and supernatural in words. And if you comb through the Old Testament, it makes many references to God speaking reality into existence. But what's coupled with it is they are called wise words. So it's not just blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. It is words that depict how God imagined reality and where things ought to be. Now, even that, though, isn't exactly right, but it's an accommodation for the fact that we live in time, space, history. Here's what I mean. Words are a lagging indicator of what you already imagine. In fact, we already know from brain science that what you depict, what you imagine in your mind that you're unaware of, and what you feel about it actually precedes the words that form in your mouth. So they simply are a lagging indicator of what you already imagine. And so when we say this of God, we understand eternity. There's not a lag. There's not time and space and what have you. Everything is one big now, one big today. But in fact, the easiest way for us to think about it is God has imagined what the heavens and the earth ought to look like, and he speaks them into existence. So that's what we mean by lagging. We know this, the language I'm using right now, is an accommodation because it's the best way that we can imagine what our words and how did God create. So Father, Son, Spirit, when they said, let us make them in our image, they already have in their imagination what that image is, and they're speaking it into existence. So first of all, our words really matter because we're made in God's image.
And Mike, so God used words. Where's the connection to us in that? I mean, he used words to create us, but part of it is he used us, you know, when he created us, he gave us the ability to speak. So why is it important, like what words we use there? I there's still a gap there for me.
That's right. Ah, little butterfly, come along with me. I think that was Karate Kid, but I'm not sure. Probably dating myself. Okay, well, you can't get into creation of us because something precedes all this. And so we must now go back, even before creation. Now, if you go into the mystical eternity past, before there is the heavens and the earth, if you read in the book of Isaiah and Ezekiel, you read of a great cosmic war or a conflict that broke out. You ever heard of this, Pat?
Sure. Yeah. Angels, the dragon. I think you might see that in Revelation, but yes.
Yes. So for the uninitiated, here's a recap of the great war. It begins with Lucifer. Now, who is Lucifer?
AKA the devil, Satan.
AKA. Formerly known as Prince. No, I'm kidding. he is considered to be like one of the greatest, if not the greatest, created beings.
Right. I mean, prior to him being Satan, he is, right. That's what you're
so getting. Don't jump ahead there. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's right. So he is awesome. Now, if you read somewhere along the way, and we don't know why, mostly because you file this under none of our business, he decides he's going to become equal with God. And we read in Isaiah and Ezekiel seven phrases, which really do cap off as seven denotes a completion, that this is complete lunacy. He says, I will ascend to the Most High. I will exalt myself. I wasn't counting, but I think that's seven. And now here is the important point. Those are words, but they have no meaningful connection to reality. Is it even remotely possible that Lucifer could become equal with God?
No, no.
So this is important, Pat. Before we come into the heavens and the earth, is a war breaks out because Lucifer uses words that have lost their meaningful connection to reality. Let me say that again for listeners. Or, and one of the great things about technology is you can hit pause. Lucifer introduces language and words that have lost their meaningful connection to reality. Now, I submit to you that the central thrust of Lucifer's work that we're going to see here on earth is to cause people to use words that have lost their meaningful connection to reality. But we'll get there in a moment. So a war breaks out. And the angels, of which we don't know how many, but the heavenly host, which could be just, you know, millions and billions, we don't know. It's just humongous. They choose sides. And do you remember how many go one way and how many go the other?
I do not. Is it maybe a third or something?
There you go. So a third side with Lucifer and two-thirds side with the triune God, Father, Son, Spirit, and a war breaks out. We can't even imagine what that's like. All we know is what is recorded is that God wins, Lucifer and his host of angels lose. So now you have in heaven fallen beings. What are you going to do about that?
Send them somewhere else.
Send them somewhere else. That's right. Send them somewhere else. Well, the problem is there is nowhere else. There's only eternity, heaven. So now, listen to this. We know in the book of Isaiah and Ezekiel, it says they are cast to the earth. Hence, how does the Bible open? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Have you ever wondered why he distinguishes between the heavens and the earth?
Not until this very moment.
Makes it worth it to get up early in the morning, doesn't it?
No, it is, I mean, it's a fascinating perspective on that. Obviously, so we don't talk about that much. But
we don't talk much about that. Yeah. Now, all the way up for 1,800 years of church history, right up until the Enlightenment really became the air we breathe here, especially in Western Christianity, we understood the heavens as somewhere between 3 and 7 spheres expanding out. It's where time and space and stars, and it's the domain of angels and God who is present. And the first heaven is the atmosphere. If you stretch out your arms like I'm doing in every direction, it is the atmosphere that God saturates. It's the air going in your nostrils and in your mouth and into your lungs. And God bathes all of that. And so in the beginning, God created the heavens. That means that he, Father, Son, Spirit, and his angelic realm saturate all of these spheres. This is why, again, we repeat in the Lord's Prayer, there is the kingdom of the heavens, all the spheres, And we pray that your will be done as it always happens in heaven, outside and beyond this sphere, these spheres. Two different kingdoms, not different, but distinguished rather. God is present in all of them. And so in the beginning, God created the heavens, plural, and the earth. Now, what will distinguish the earth? What distinguishes the earth already and what is about to be one of the distinctive marks of the earth? But when it's created, what's one of the distinguishing marks? We know, but the reader doesn't. And what's that?
Distinguishing marks of the earth?
Yes, based on what we've just heard about this cosmic conflict that came before the heavens and the earth were created.
Well, that's where the angels that had sided with Lucifer were cast down into the earth.
As well as Lucifer.
Right, right.
The serpent, the devil. So the angels are fallen, so they're often called now demons or fallen angels. That's right. But they're quarantined. Oh, that's a good phrase now that we think about the world we're living in. And where are they quarantined? It might be symbolic, but they don't have any dominion or power here. They are quarantined. Where?
That's a good question. they're quarantined to the earth. Are you asking specifically
That's right.
where the earth?
That's right. They're in that computer you have every time it goes buggy. I know. They are quarantined. Where are they quarantined? But here's the tip off. We'll return to these 6 days of creation by speaking. But on that sixth day, let us make them in our image and let them have dominion. That's right, in these heavens and the earth. Let them rule, let them multiply. I believe that is so because God wants to wed his joy with his creation that we are designed. God wants to marry us, and he wants a bride who's got dirt under her fingernails, who's not some kind of ditz, but actually knows what this is all about. And he places them in a garden, and he says, have at it. Have at it the whole thing except
the tree of knowledge of good and evil.
The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What does that mean?
Very literally, they were given the garden, and they could not eat of one tree in the garden, which was the knowledge of good and evil. That implies that both of those things already existed. So
that's right.
Good was there, evil was there. If it wasn't, we wouldn't have knowledge of it.
That's right. If evil wasn't on the earth, then God used language that had lost its meaningful connection to reality. Evil? What are you talking about? There is no evil. There is evil. And we know this because in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What are the next several words? Do you remember them?
No. <That's good. laughs> I was hoping it would come, but nope.
That answer has a meaningful connection to reality. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Catch this. And the earth was formless and void. Formless and void is a Hebrew phrase with ominous overtones of judgment. You can imagine it this way. And something is lurking in the bushes. Evil. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless and void. the Hebrews would read that and go, what is it? And God begins to order the disorder. By ordering the disorder, the instigator of disorder, the great tempter, the great liar, is quarantined. And so when he puts Adam and Eve in the garden, he says, have at it. Mix, match, create, go crazy, make love. Well, the reason I mentioned make love is God is love, and he is our maker. And the first thing they do, we read, is they make love. That's what it means when he says, after naming all the animals, Adam goes to sleep that night and goes, yeah, he can't really put language to it, but it's just like, that was fun, but it wasn't awesome. Something I can't put my finger on it. Oh, that's a good little phrase to use. I can't put my finger on it. He's about to put his finger on it. Because he wakes up the next morning and there's Eve. Holy smokies. And the language he uses depicts bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Wow, he's zowie. And he puts more than his finger on. He puts his hands, they put their hands on one another, and they make love. And the language used of that sort of knowledge, that's what it's called, is because later on, Adam knew Eve, and she conceived. So knowledge is the things you put your hands to, that you ingest, that you taste and touch and feel and smell. And God says, now there's one tree over there. It's the knowledge of good and evil. Knowledge. Now, Pat, it says good and evil. So there is a, first of all, as Roger Shattuck said many years ago, there is such a thing as forbidden knowledge. Why would some knowledge of good be forbidden?
The thing that comes to mind for me would be some element of preparedness. So I think of raising a kid almost, and there's some good things that they don't know as a child. They shouldn't quite know as a child. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, that's really good, Pat. Shoot, man. I'm going to shut up, just let you take it from here. I think that's very good. It's remember when Moses said, show me your face? What did God say?
You're not ready for it. You can't see it. You can't handle it.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, that's right. You'd explode. You'd be incinerated. So I can't show you my glory. So there is such a thing as forbidden knowledge that God veils, because it's just, until we're transfigured, this is like, you have no idea. You can't stand next to, I'm reading right now about, for example, the first tests of the hydrogen bomb out in the Pacific. You couldn't get near that. Mm. There'd be nothing left of you. And the first hydrogen bomb, when they went down the ocean floor, carved out a trench over a mile long, 175 feet deep. You just couldn't, you can't get near that kind of stuff. So that's what I mean by the knowledge of good and the knowledge of evil. That means that you can be aware that such a thing exists, but you don't touch it. Now, once we're there, we understand now the power of language. It is a lagging cultural indicator. We don't know why. But somehow, in some warped way, Lucifer began to imagine, dadgummit, I'm as good as God. I am going to become just like him. So all the language you use simply depicts what's already gotten there first, is how we imagine things. A quick example would be, that if you walked in my home and we had little kids, we had our grandkids here, and when you walked in, you saw me slap Sage's hand. And if you imagine slapping is bad, then you would, your words out of your mouth would be like, what are you doing? Or, and it would be in a judgmental sort of way that I don't imagine what you're doing is very good. Now, if you walked in and you imagined and saw a larger picture, that is, the gas stove is on, she's about to put her hand into a flame, and by slapping, I've saved her flesh. How do you imagine that slap?
It was a good slap. It was a safe slap.
That's right. So imagination always beats language to the punch, is a way to think about it. And that's why we often say, if you go outside and your car is gone, and you sit there and go, oh, and you use profanity, it's because your imagination had already beaten you to the punch. My car is here. That's where it ought to be. And you go outside, and the first thing is, what the? That's why language is a lagging indicator. And so God creates by language. So we'll speed the film up just a bit. But until you know and see the sacredness of language, then you'll never understand what is profanity. Because profanity assumes that some language is profane. But it can't be profane if it's not sacred. And we live in a world where most people don't really understand language as sacred. The old little phrase, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me, is exactly wrong. Sticks and stones and words, and the words actually scar far deeper, far longer. For example, it's been said, if you want to raise your daughter to be shy, constantly say to her, now don't be shy. If you want to raise your child to be fearful, say, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. You're lodging a thought in there. Well, why should I be afraid? I mean, I understand these are kind of complex mental exercises that you're not thinking your child is going through. But in fact, if you introduce that, don't have sex till you get married. Why? Why not? Why would you even say that? Why are you afraid? Why are you? Most parents unwittingly are passing along most of their insecurities of the Christians I know. And because of all the things that they communicate to the kids, they're fearful they won't do. And they end up doing them. You sit there and go, why would they do that? You kind of introduced me to a boundary. Not unlike if you drive down the highway, which says 60 or 70, what are the majority of people doing?
Going.
How fast are they?
Likely 10 miles, if not more, over that.
Yeah, that's right. There's just something about the law.
Got to push that edge.
Now, my older brother, his entire career was as a police chief, all sorts of little towns and small towns. And so one of the things Robert taught me, I shouldn't be passing this on, but he says, at one point he said, well, generally we'll let you go, you know, up to 10 miles an hour over. And he shouldn't have told me that. Yeah, there's just something about that. So if you lodge in their mind, no, don't do that, don't do that. I know the Bible says thou shalt not. I get it. And there's a reason why. And it's exactly right. But when you start there, you're inviting more trouble than you ever imagined, because it's a lagging cultural indicator. And it indicates less about God's prohibitions and more about your insecurities. Think about that.
Yeah. Jeez.
So once we're clear on what's going on here, how does Lucifer tempt Eve?
Well, Lucifer gets her to eat the apple from this tree that she's not supposed to eat from.
Well, that's the result, the outcome.
Mm.
What device does he use?
He uses language. He tells her, well, is what God said really going to happen?
He breaks the meaningful connection mm-hmm. between words and reality. Did God really say? If you are super, super brilliant, you're going to be more subtle than most Christians imagine. And so if we imagine, yeah, red tail, red costume, oh, my friend. So he uses words that have lost their meaningful connection to reality. They're still words. They still have all the power of God's creation, but they have lost their meaningful connection. In other words, because they are created by God, they always will have the power. When we talk about, for example, when I talk with young people about sexuality, God created our sexuality. He created sex. He created climax. And whether or not you're a follower of him and even understand it, he doesn't say, now you're not going to really enjoy it. Yes, you do enjoy it. Now, it's what happens afterward that is depicted in the Proverbs is the long tail of afterglow tends to dissipate more quickly, but it doesn't necessarily reduce the intensity. And so the words, because they are God created words, have the intensity, even used by Lucifer, but they've lost their meaningful connection to reality. Now I'm going to fast forward the film a bit, Pat, and then come back to this, because one of the things that infects Western Christianity is we're big on intensity.
What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things that came out of the 1800s evangelical movement was this idea of personalizing the gospel, making it more personal. It unwittingly dipped its toes then into individualism, which is seen by most of our worship songs now are in the first person singular. And the second outcome was beginning somewhere about the 1980s, passion, which is generally in the Bible, is something to be very careful with. Coming out of Madison Avenue became an unalloyed good. And so we can be passionate about this. And I used to teach a course for young people, and I had them in just any given week find as many references to passion as they could. One Monday morning, they came in over 50. Everything from Lexus to Novartis to fruit juice to... The Bible has one reference that's positive to passion, and it reflects sexual consummation with your spouse. The other ones are negative. For example, don't be like the donkey when his passion is in heat, and so on and so forth. The point is, passion is supposed to depict the eternity and consummation with our bridegroom, Jesus. And nobody can live in continual orgasm. Nobody. God didn't make it that way. Not here on earth, rather. In eternity, yes. And I don't want to go there right now today. It's just, that's what it depicts. It's timeless. It is nuptial union and climax is timeless. You're not sitting there at climax going, I wonder what the stock market is going to do today. But because of that, passion is momentary. It is only depicted in a positive way in Corinthians, where it denotes nuptial union, And every other place it's warned against because it's so easy to be flighty or superficial or frankly ridiculous about it. And so for some reason, I'll tell you why, perhaps here on this one, but Madison Avenue was the first to dip into passion as this unalloyed good. We can be passionate about everything. And now I don't expect Madison Avenue to understand human nature, but it is indicative, again, of how the church is no longer in the reality business, because we no longer influence the culture-shaping institutions. One would be Madison Avenue. In fact, I've only ever heard one Christian talk about that the way we talk about passion is language that has lost its meaningful connection to reality. Mm-hmm. So that's what we mean by it. So I fast forward the film because, first of all, our language in Western Christianity is overwhelmingly first person singular, whereas you go back throughout the history of the earlier renditions or traditions in the church, as well as Judaism, as well as Genesis, let us, plural, Father, Son, Spirit, make them, plural, in our, plural, image. And so, yes, while we are individuals, our larger identity is we are created to be married to them. So that's what I mean by lagging cultural indicator. And so God creates Adam. He begins to name reality. What does he do before Eve? Do you remember?
Adam is responsible for naming the animals.
That's right. So again, he imagines them and comes up with a word. Okay. Dog, cat, cockatiel. And God blesses all that. That, by the way, is fascinating. Because this is kind of mind-blowing beyond what we can fully wrap our mind around. Is, did God whisper in his ear, "Oh, that's a cat. Call that a cat." No instance of that, is there?
No.
It's not in the record. And so you have this sense of Father, Son, Spirit sitting back and say, "This is fun. Watch. Watch what's going to happen. He's going to be like us. Go." So dog, cat, snake, cocktail. And I used to have a cocktail. So I think I forgot to feed it for a while and it died. Now, bear that in mind, because when Jesus breathes his spirit into his disciples after his resurrection, he says, whoever you forgive here on earth will be forgiven in heaven. And whoever you don't forgive here will not be forgiven in heaven. Whoa. Mm. Sounds like we're in charge. Well, we'll talk about that another day. But you do get this sense that the words he uses, they are not just words. And the words Lucifer uses are not just words. And the words that Adam uses when he wakes up and here is Eve, those words are laced through with erotica. And I would urge readers, by the way, Christopher West has a new book, Our Bodies Tell God's Story, because Christopher makes a great point that Genesis says the way that you get to agape is through eros. The way you experience God's love is through your bodily love, which is inherently good. Erotic is inherently good love. Yes, I know it can be corrupted, but so can agape. So can everything. But it's inherently good. And that too in our lagging cultural indicator, very few people think that way in Western Christianity. Funny story, when I was a pastor way back in the day, I was going through Genesis at our church, and this a woman came up to me afterward, and she goes, you know, I'm pretty upset by this sermon. And I said, well, why is that? She goes, well, you're talking about Adam and Eve and, you know, nuptial union. And I said, well, what do you imagine is happening there when Adam knew Eve and she conceived? And she said, I just don't even imagine it.
Wow.
Now she meant well.
Sure.
But when you're raised, when you, cultures are the water going through our gills. And if you and I, Peck, go to the Anacostia River in D.C. and we pull a fish out and we say, you know, that's pretty dirty water. The fish is going to look at us like, what are you talking about? That's the only water I know. In fact, I'm not even aware of it. In fact, now I'm aware of it because you take a fish out of water and they wiggle like crazy because they're telling you, I want back in that water. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to say, it's polluted. And they go, what is polluted? That's language that has no meaningful connection to reality. So we're often famous for language which has no meaningful, it's lost rather, its meaningful connection to reality. So before we head into profanity and the rest, hit the pause button because we only have a few more minutes. Questions?
For me, no. I think I'm still up to speed with you. So far we've talked about we can't understand profanity if we don't understand the sacredness of language. And
that's right.
we begin to understand that, get a glimpse of that. It's hard if we don't already know, because maybe the culture that we were raised in, we just never talked about that. But if we start to look back at Genesis, we start to get a glimpse of how language is actually sacred.
Yes. and that's why I was raised in a thick, what's called a thick liturgical tradition. And every Sunday you would hear the passage, therefore, let your words be few. Why would that be written in scripture?
It's very easy to speak words that aren't meaningfully connected. So it's very easy to profane words. So speak right. Fewer of them. Your odds are better.
That's right. Fewer. I mean, that's it. It's just like, that ought to be a bumper sticker. That's great. That's great advice. True. And here's why. So in Matthew 12, Jesus says, you will give an account of every careless word you utter in the day of judgment. You will give account of every careless word you utter. Let me reframe profane. Many, many years ago, the late comedian George Carlin had a famous skit. I believe it was even on network television. Maybe, probably not. It was probably just a nightclub act. It was called The Seven Words You Can't Say on NBC. Google it. Carlin, who is actually maniacally brilliant, was pointing out, you say these words enough, they begin to sound meaningless. And so, if I recall correctly, because he had various renditions of the skit, because it was flat out funny. But here was one of his points. So take the word shit and just start applying it to everything. So how are you doing today? Man, I feel like shit. Oh, yeah, that's shitty. Yeah, I know, man. Like for shit, yeah. Well, how's your karma? I like shit. Really? Yeah, well, that's just an shitty day, isn't it? Yeah, I know. I like shit. You get the point. It's a lot funnier when you actually say the word, but I don't want to offend some of the listeners. Here's the point. Americans' vocabulary shrunk by over 50% in the last 100 years. I can't give you the exact figure. It's not coming to mind right now. And I don't want to use language that has lost its meaningful connection to reality. But we use far fewer words. So when someone might have said in the past, how's your car running today? You know, there's a pinging and a clicking in there. I just can't really put my finger on it. I'm having trouble discovering where it is. Instead, we go, that's shitty. And what'd you think of that movie? You know, there was parts of it. I just think it didn't really pull out the main point particularly well. No, it's just S-H-I-T-T-Y. What we're actually showing in our language and the vocabulary of Americans, which has shrunk dramatically, is first of all, we don't understand language as being sacred. And second, there's far more profanity than we ever realize. And profanity can be this. It could be as simple as anything that profanes, that breaks the meaningful connection. It could be as simple as this. How are you doing? Oh, Jesus and I are doing awesome. I love you, Lord, with all my heart. You realize how self-aware you'd have to be to make that statement and have those words have a meaningful connection to reality? Do you realize how a better grasp of this might cause you to say, you know, if God grades on the curve, I think I'm doing okay. I think I love the Lord 51% of the time. That's what I'm wrestling with. But I think there's some of my loves are profoundly out of order. Here's a bigger thing I also see, because Western Christianity is known for a couple of things. One is, again, this bastardization of the idea of passion. Very simplistic language. And the other thing is I learned when I did my pastoral internship in England, after I gave my first sermon, this very wise woman came up to me. First of all, she said, when you felt like a bum, you might want to know that here in England, that means ass. And that's why you saw heads bob a bit. I said, thank you very much. And then she said, and by the way, you Americans, you don't understand superlatives. Save your superlatives for something that's superlative.
Wow.
And here's what she meant. We're famous for, this is incredible. This is awesome. This is, oh man, God is going to move through this city. It's going to be awesome. We've got an incredible thing. The problem, if you use them up, first of all, you create cynics in the pew because people begin to not listen because, well, that thing was supposed to be awesome last year. That was supposed to be incredible. That was supposed to be. And it sure doesn't look like it played out that way. I was talking yesterday to a man, sent me a LinkedIn thing, and generally I say yes, and I go, who is this person? So I, next thing I know, he called me, lives right here in town. And if I were to summarize the conversation, he's 60 years old and he's saying, I'm so tired of all this over-the-top language of how this stuff's just going to rock the city and be. And he goes, I've lived in Annapolis all my life. I'm not seeing any impact. Nothing appreciable, nothing sustainable, nothing systemic. So that's what I mean by we use superlatives. And then if something truly awesome were to happen, we've used it up. And she, the man who mentored me said, you do better to use comparatives. And comparatives say things like, you know, how you doing? Well, fair here, okay here. I mean, Kathy and I are doing well, but we've got this and this we're working through and we're wrestling with that. And now the problem again with American attention spans is you lost that listener way back when you said, well, you know, if God grades on them, everything you said after that is gone because they're going, I just want to hear you're an awesome man.
Or I wasn't really asking. I was just saying hi.
Yeah, I was just, that's right. What do you think I meant that? My question had no meaningful connection to reality. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. In Ephesians, Paul writes, so first of all, Jesus says, every careless word you utter. So what does that imply?
Take care
in what you say.
Right.
Take care. Hence, in Ephesians, you will read that we're supposed to use words that build up. And when we don't, that reflect reality, it says we grieve the Spirit of God. Our words grieve the Spirit of God. Why would they grieve the Spirit of God?
Well, they're not meaningfully connected to reality. And in that process, we actually are not reflecting God. We're not acting as Adam did, where he was mirroring God.
Yes, and we're reflecting, actually, the three great enemies in Scripture: the world, the flesh, and the devil. So if you reverse the order, that's what happened in Genesis 3. Lucifer, who breaks the meaningful connection between words and reality, appeals to Eve's flesh and then to Adam's. They eat, and the world falls. The world, the flesh, and the devil. All three originally created to be good. Devil, unredeemable. Flesh, redeemable. World, redeemable. But our language has to reflect and depict reality. And if you go back to Genesis, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and void, and the Spirit of God hovered over all of this. The Spirit of God, I say, was the production manager, construction engineer, supervisor, superintendent over creation. So he still superintends in our lives and over this world. And when he hears us say things like, yeah, man, I'm all over that. I'm, you know, like, yeah, man, I'm 100% in. Yeah, man, I'm so excited. It probably would boggle the mind of most believers to know that we grieve the Spirit, because he who searches all things says, Mike, that's not true of you. That's not true. Why are you doing this? Well, we're doing it because we're people with good hearts, but it's the water going through our gills. And the water going through our gills, as one of my favorite authors, Flannery O'Connor, many years ago said, is everything's got to be upbeat. Everything's got to be positive. She called it the great heresy, by the way. Positive. Everything's got to be upbeat and pumped up. Come on, people. And it's just, I know it's an erotic image, but that's how we get to agape. It's like living in continual orgasm. And I think the rise of religious nuns, in part, they can't give language to it, but when I've given language to it, they go, dang, that's it. And they actually have said before, damn, that's it. And that damn is not profane. That damn is not profane. They're saying, damn, I want to be spiritual, but the spirituality I hear in the church is not sustainable. It's not real. It's not real. So I am spiritual, but I'm not religious. And that is also a damn shame, because James said, we ought to be religious. This is true religion, he said. Christianity is a religion. I would not be one of, like to be one of those Christians who always touts, you know, we're in a relationship with God. We're not into religion. Well, you're going to meet James one day in eternity. He's going to say, why did you say that? Religion is Latin meaning rebind, religio, ligament. Ligament binds bone to muscle so that you can actually move. And so religion rebinds us to what we ought to be and who we ought to be and what creation ought to be. And we're running around saying we're not into religion. That's words that have lost their meaningful connection to reality. Those are careless words. I don't think most of us, me included, take seriously. You're going to give an account of that one day, Mike. Because that grieves my spirit, because that's not imaging God. And so words are a lagging cultural indicator, and profane words, because words are sacred, are those that have lost their meaningful connection to reality. And without a doubt, there are many times, probably more often than not, particularly the F word is profane. The F word originally came out in 1568. Now I'm going to close with this. It roughly parallels the rise of the Enlightenment. So think about this. In the Enlightenment, the notion was we change through our brain primarily, almost exclusively. Think right, act right. But in older traditions, you think with your body. And the gospel is best told in our body, in our sexuality. If you take that away, a lagging cultural indicator will be people who strive to get back to what it means that we're sexual beings. So they will use language that is erotic but profane to try to find the heavens that are all around them. And so everything will start to become F. And in that regard, even though it's profane, it's telling you of this deep longing of, damn it, where is this kingdom of the heavens that's supposed to be all around us? Mm-hmm.